up, Sasnacks. It's Chelsea back for another episode of the Sasnack Files. This week, we are discussing part two of The Amber Brooch by Catherine Lowry Logan. But before we get to that, I want to take a moment to remind you that you can find the Sasnack Files on all sorts of listening platforms, including iTunes, CastBox, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, iHeartRadio, and many more. Also, if you have not had a chance yet, make sure you head over to follow the Sasnack Files on both Facebook and Instagram to make sure you are up to date on all of the latest and greatest news concerning Outlander seasons 7 and 8, as well as Blood of My Blood, Men in Kilts, and anything Diana Gabaldon cooks up. And with all of that out of the way, let's get into the next edition of Droughtlander Book Club on The Amber Brooch by Catherine Lowry Logan. We're going to start out talking about Amber because last week I spent the majority of the time talking about Olivia and Connor and Rick and the clan as a whole and the brooch mythology and all of that stuff. This week, we're primarily going to focus on Amber, Daniel, Noah, and a lot of the stuff that happens in the 19th century portion of the timeline. First topic of discussion is Amber. She's one of our protagonists, so I feel like before we start any sort of discussion, we really need to focus on her. We didn't talk about her much last week, and that was by design, but I think it's just noteworthy that her and her sister Olivia are just complete opposites in so many ways. They each have their own personality quirks. But Amber's pretty musically inclined, I would say. I think she's probably one of the most gifted musicians of the clan as it stands. Rick is probably the most talented. But as we go further on into these books, we get so many new additions and everybody seems musically inclined in some way, shape, or form, whether they sing or play an instrument. And Amber plays the guitar and the banjo and she sings. This rolls into her performance at the Tabor Opera House. I think it also lends itself to her bonding with Rick and David. It also is a heck of a turn on for Daniel. He loves watching her sing. That might have been the first real spark for them, is him watching her perform at Tabor Opera House. When she gets this Martin guitar, first off, I had no idea what a Martin guitar was, but apparently they're very, very, very expensive and valuable. So she finds her Martin guitar made of rosewood and ebony, and I might not be into instruments, but I can appreciate something that's beautiful, and I can only imagine how gorgeous this instrument is. Another huge part of Amber is her supernatural tendencies. And I find this interesting, especially because each of the Kelly sisters has some sort of vision or premonition, but the way that they get those premonitions is completely different. And so that's why I didn't really want to lump them together into one discussion topic. Amber's visions are more of an internal knowing, if that makes sense, whereas Olivia's are a literal vision, a flash of the future and seeing people's faces that she will eventually meet. Olivia's visions are much more tangible, I guess, whereas Amber just has to trust her instincts. There are a couple of ways that we see this play out in the story. Part of Rick and Amber's bond is that they both have that intuition. And so when Rick gives her the advice of, if you're sure where you want to end up, let that guide the decisions you make while you're here, he's very much into trusting your instincts. And when he gives Amber that piece of advice, it's almost giving her permission to accept the way that she feels and let that guide her decisions and really put stock in her own instincts. There's one premonition that Amber has. She is in the carriage, I think, going to Denver. It says she had the strangest sensation that the roads she and her sister were traveling would take them not only to different destinations, but to different spiritual ones as well. There's just something nagging at her that something's going to happen in Denver and it's going to be completely opposite of what's happening to her sister, but that somehow it's going to be linked, you know? It's just that thing niggling the back of her head. And then those visions progressively get more and more to the forefront of her mind, I guess. There's a scene where Amber's talking to Daniel. It's when they're in the dressing room after she performs that first night. She has a vision of Daniel standing in her kitchen, dressed in modern clothes, drinking a glass of wine. It's very reminiscent of JL's vision of what happened to the amethyst brooch in the cave at the end of The Broken Brooch. So that really sent up a red flag for me. I'm wondering how all of these women that have all of these visions are connected. There's got to be some relation or something in there. I mean, I know they're all McClintis technically. It's just they're very distantly related. So that's interesting. It makes me ponder. But the big one, I think, as far as that instinctual knowledge that Amber has, is her and Daniel are talking about whether Amber is a virgin or not and whether he'll be her first and stuff like that. She admits, obviously, that she's not a virgin, and it's a critical conversation for them to have as a couple, but that's not the point of the conversation. The point is how that conversation ends. When Amber says, when those sorts of premonitions invaded her psyche, they scared her, and this one scared the hell out of her. She didn't want to analyze what it could mean. And that's because some part of her is telling her, no, Daniel wouldn't be her first, but he would be her last. Which, I mean, I guess is all part of the soulmate connection. It's like Angel says, that makes you go, So I felt like it was worth mentioning, especially given everything that we learn in the series moving forward about different people's gifts and things like that. Hers is one of the more subtle gifts, I will say that, but it's definitely there. There's no denying it. The next topic, I call it lawyer by day and paleontologist by night. This is the topic that really makes me excited because, first off, I'm a paleontology nerd. So this portion of the book and of the series really got me excited when I heard that there were dinosaurs in this book. I was like, I am here for it. Okay. Amber's passion, besides being a chef, I mean, that's definitely a passion of hers, but that's something that she came to a little bit later in life. She's currently a lawyer. She has a successful mining practice that is kind of in conjunction to her parents' law practice. She studied geology at Yale and then got her master's in paleontology from the University of Chicago. Obviously, none of that is relevant to 1878. Women didn't go to college in 1878. There were very few places that women could get degrees. And so Amber had to make up her new curriculum vitae whenever she is trying to pass the bar and give the judge all of her information and also try to make up a convincing story. She had to come up with this resume of attending Smith College in Hartford, studying under Dr. Marsh at Yale, and then earning a bachelor's of law from Union College of Law in Chicago. The only reason that she's able to come up with that is because she has a historical knowledge of what women around that time have already accomplished based on the history books. So she has a pretty good idea of what would formulate a convincing argument. The thing about Amber being a lawyer, she is a hard-ass negotiator. Like, this is one of the prevalent things about her personality. It's this aspect of her that allows her to get $350 out of Horace Tabor, which he's a hard businessman and he doesn't easily fold. At the time, Horace Tabor was the governor of Colorado and was one of the richest men in that area at the time. So he was a very prominent member of society, but he was also kind of shady. You never know what you're going to get when you approach him, but she's a damn good lawyer and she knows what she's doing. Thank God that Daniel trusted her with that. She is a woman. And while he watched her stand for the bar exam and he knows she knows what she's talking about, there's still a portion of him that doesn't fully believe that she could be a good lawyer. There's that misogynistic tendency that most 19th century men had, where you're just like, only men can be in positions of power and make good decisions, and women are too emotional, et cetera, et cetera. But this is really the first time that we see that flicker of a quality that's really admirable in the fact that he's man enough to accept when he's wrong. He's very flustered by watching her negotiate these. And I think he's absolutely in shock whenever she emerges from Tabor's office and is like, I won you $350. And he's like, oh, $3.50. And she's like, no, $350 and the dog. And he just doesn't know how on earth she could do it until he watches her negotiate her own performance contract for Tabor Opera House. And then he's like, damn. Okay, then. So it's really cool watching that initial interaction between them. But I think this type of interaction is also the first in many little red flags for Daniel. He knows that she's not who she says she is, and watching her have this sort of legal prose, he's suspicious by nature anyway. So that is something that doesn't sit right with him, even though it's impressive. Amber's interest in paleontology is the reason that she decided to go into mining law, because that kind of flows into her knowledge of geology. But I also feel like her love of paleontology is its own beast in a way. She's so excited about hunting fossils in Morrison. She feels like a kid again. She just cannot wait to go. She's squirming in her seat like she's got ants in her pants. At this point in the story, when it's looking like she's gonna get to go, she's willing to do whatever it takes, whatever Rick asks of her. Like, she will see some 19th century doctor and do this treatment. It's probably not going to do any good, but she'll do it if Rick wants her to, if that means that she gets to go dig for fossils. She's so, I hesitate to say ridiculous. Yes, from up above, we can say she's ridiculous, but you know, I'm willing to do some crazy shit for the things that I'm passionate about. So I can't really judge her in that respect. I mean, I think dinosaurs are cool. I don't know much about the paleontology of it all, but I love dinosaurs. In line with this paleontology passion of hers, we start to see this selfish streak emerge for her. And it's something that I touched on a little bit last week. This is a marked difference between her and the previous brooch women that we've seen. I mean, they all are very strong, independent women. And Amber's no exception to that. I think where we see the difference is when we're talking about what Amber will do with nobody else's best interests in mind. And that all goes back to her randomly disappearing to go dig up fossils or hang out with a guy. And she won't tell anybody where she's going or how long she's going to be gone for. Everybody in her family freaks out. And then a few days later, she shows back up and she's like, oh, sorry about that. That would be so annoying to me. As much of an ass as the sheriff is, I can't blame him for behaving the way that he does, because this is a repeating pattern with her. And it's easy to get jaded and think she's just crying wolf again. This is the kind of crap that you just don't do. You don't pull these stunts, because then if there's a real emergency, nobody's going to come rushing to your aid. Again, that all goes back to that initial story that we hear from Olivia about how she got in trouble when Amber wandered into the mine when they were kids and Amber got praised. And that cements in a child's head, and that child will eventually grow to an adult, that they can do what they want and there's no repercussions. That's what we see with Amber and her following her curiosity and her desire to go hunt for dinosaur fossils and not feel like she needs to take anyone else into consideration. And we see that mindset flow over into whenever she arrives in 1878. After the initial process of her realizing that she is in a different time, she talks to a few guys and she sees what these miners are finding. And she sees this 16-carat rhodochrosite, which for me doesn't mean diddly squat. And for most people, doesn't mean anything. But Amber knows that it's extremely valuable. And all this guy wants for it is 25 cents. And she knows, yeah, she should probably go home. But at the same time, why would I go home? If I can get my hands on some money, I can make out like a bandit. I can find all of these geological things, like all these fun rocks, and take them home with me and make buku bucks or add them to my collection or whatever she wants to do with them. in 1878, the mining fields in Leadville were so rich with all of these mineral deposits and stuff that there is way more to find in 1878 than there is in the 21st century. And so she can find some really cool stuff and not pay half of what she would back in her time. Despite the fact that she should probably go home and she knows that, she doesn't. It's an adventure for her. A lot of the women are scared shitless in previous books whenever they first go back in time. I mean, look at Kinsey. She was dropped in the middle of a bombing raid. Now, Amber is in her element. She knows, historically speaking, what's going on, where she is, and roughly the practices and traditions of that time. So she fits in very well automatically. And she's not dropped into a war zone like a lot of women. So yeah, she has no reason to immediately want to go back, and she doesn't. A huge thing that is prevalent in Amber's story and is weaved throughout very seamlessly, just little clues dropped here and there, is her deteriorating health. We initially notice it right after she arrives in Leadville. Her heart is fluttering. She's not sure what it is, but she's pretty sure it's altitude sickness. Like, she just can't draw in enough air. And it's particularly noticeable right after she saves Noah, which could easily be exertion following up with just getting to a higher elevation. You know, like, maybe her body isn't adjusted to it yet. But as we get further into the story, her health condition gets worse and worse and worse. And she manages to cover it up enough that David and Kenzie are like, okay, you're probably right. It's just altitude sickness. We'll go home. But if it gets worse, you have to come back. Don't play around with your health. It's not worth it. Obviously, that goes in one ear and out the other. Again, her selfish streak. But in this case, her wants and needs are warring with herself. It's not really impacting anyone else. I mean, it's impacting her family and the fact that if she'd gotten herself killed, they would have had to deal with the fallout. Obviously, she's not going to be around and she would rather go hunt for dinosaur fossils. And she hates doctors anyway. So obviously, she's going to put off going to the doctor until there is no other option. She's so sick that she has to talk to an expert. She's a perpetual symptom Googler. She is one of those people that rather than go to the doctor and have a test done, she just Googles it. It's like, I have a sore throat and a fever. What do I have? This series of sore throats that she's been dealing with off and on for the better part of probably her adult life have actually been untreated strep throat. And I know a little bit about this because I Googled it a couple of times ago when I had a really sore throat. And I was like, should I go to the doctor? Should I not go to the doctor? And I actually read about this rheumatic heart disease. And like, if you have a series of untreated strep throats, it could result in rheumatic heart disease. Please seek a doctor if you think you have strep throat. That scared the shit out of me. So how she just didn't ever go to the doctor ever just blows my mind. She ends up having this rheumatic heart disease. And we see this progressively going downhill. It initially starts out with accelerated heart rate, slight trouble breathing, but she's able to, you know, with a few deep breaths, calm it down. And then it eventually just falls off a cliff. By the time they get to the Robinson house in Denver, her fatigue is so bad that the maidservant has to wrap her arm around Amber's waist to help her up the stairs. At that point, Daniel and Rick are very aware that something is wrong. Rick's trying to get her to go home. Daniel's trying to get her to see a 19th century doctor. And obviously, if her family in the 21st century isn't able to convince her to go see a doctor, Rick and Daniel aren't going to be able to convince her to see a 19th century doctor. It's just not going to happen. If she doesn't have faith in 21st century medicine, she sure as hell not going to have faith in 19th century medicine. By the time she gets to Denver, she's aware of how sick she is. It's not a question anymore. It's just her trying to force herself through it because she wants so badly to go meet Dr. Lakes and find the location of his fossil quarries and talk to him. You know, she's read about all of these paleontologists for most of her life. And as a nerd, to be there in the middle of the action and help discover a Stegosaurus skeleton, that would be just freaking cool. So she's really trying to push herself, but at the same time, she's realizing the stress that she has over her health is snowballing the issue because not only is she worried about what's going on, her body's also struggling to draw in enough oxygen to help her function. by the time they go to Morrison to go to the Swiss cottage, it feels like an elephant is sitting on her chest and she's got 20-pound weights attached to her ankles. It's taking everything she has to draw herself out of bed, but she's so excited to go that she's going to do it anyway, whether it's the best decision for her or not. By the time they get to the Swiss cottage, she's not even able to get up the stairs to her room. And when they're on the train headed towards Morrison and she's talking to Noah, she's not even able to say more than a sentence without gasping for air, which is so scary. I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't call myself a regular attendee at the doctor's office, but that would scare the crap out of me. I don't know how she's pushing herself, especially when she knows this isn't a forever decision. And people have told her that, like, if you want to go back to get your heart checked out and everything else, like, we can come back. It's fine. So that just blows my mind. I know that she thinks it's a once in a lifetime opportunity, but it's really not. This is the decision I really struggle with Amber. Rick finds her on the floor, not responsive. Her lips are blue. She's pale as a sheet, like literally at death's door. They get her to a doctor. She's diagnosed with her rheumatic heart disease. The only good thing that comes out of this diagnosis is that Rick can stop blaming himself. We talked about it a lot last week. His worry over Amber combined with his own PTSD on what happened with the IED explosion really makes him blame himself for her illness and that he didn't get treatment for her sooner. The silver lining, if there is one, is that this condition has been progressing and getting worse over the course of months, if not years, and a couple of days was not going to make a difference, except for she would have been in slightly better condition for surgery. But this isn't something that progressed with the snap of a finger. She has been getting worse for a long time. And Amber even acknowledges at some point she was having trouble breathing before she even went to the cabin that day. Janine, I mean, good for her having this great sense of adventure, being a daring girl, but I sort of side with Olivia on being on the cautious side. I don't blame Olivia for calling in the cavalry. Oh, no, I'm adventurous to an extent, but I still have a sense of self-preservation, if you know what I mean. So I don't blame Olivia at all. I 100% blame Amber. And I think that this personality trait is probably the biggest drawback for me personally, reading these characters. This is the one thing that irritates me about Amber. Amber's relationship with Noah, she's not a kid person. She never has been. I identify with that. I love my niece and nephew, but I'm not a baby person. And Amber's kind of the same way. She'll coo and hold babies when her coworkers bring them into the office, but she hasn't really ever thought about having her own children. Olivia describes it as she'll draw pictures for them or sing songs, but as soon as she's done all of that, she's tapped out. That's why she thinks that it would honestly be more of a punishment to make Amber do daycare than have her perform at the sheriff's annual gala or muck out stalls, because those things don't bother Amber, but she's kind of at a loss when it comes to kids. That all changes when she meets Noah. Noah is just different from other kids, and that's not hard to see. I absolutely adore him. He's so precocious, so mature. Him showing interest in geology and paleontology, he has that zest for knowledge and knowledge about things that Amber is already knowledgeable on. Naturally, they bond over that. This wakes Amber up to the fact that not all kids are the same, but this is the first kid that she's really formed an attachment with. I'm sure that there was a bit of an imprint whenever she saved him from the wagon. There was an emotional bond that was formed there and her saving his life. They spend a lot of time together over the course of this book. And for a young boy that doesn't have a mother, that is huge to attach himself to another woman that could potentially fill that role. Obviously, that's an adult decision to make, but for a 10-year-old, he can't make sense of that. No matter how mature he is, like, he just doesn't understand why, like, my dad loves you, so why would you not get married? You know, it seems like a pretty cut and dry process for somebody that young. And I love how whenever he's telling her all of this, like, I want you to be my mom, her reaction is, holy knit one, pearl two. And she has several other, oh my God, reactions as she's trying to process. And she's really trying not to have a panic attack over this, which I feel like is how I would feel. All she wanted was to have sex with Daniel, and Noah wants her to be his mom. Whenever Kinsey told her that she was pregnant, part of her wondered what that would be like. I think I speak for a lot of women these days when I say, imagining yourself pregnant with a baby versus taking on a fully formed child that has already been partially raised and is someone else's child is a whole other ballgame. She has to be very careful with how she proceeds with this. And I think that's not something that she really thinks about until she's in waist deep and it's almost too late. That attachment is already there despite her best intentions. She does give him some great advice. She has her motherly moments, but it's not something that she ever thought was a permanent thing. You know, she gave him advice about his grandpa, saying, you know, you need to spend time with your grandpa. He just wants to show you that he loves you like he loved your ma. And he won't always be around. And she's drawing on her personal experience with her grandma. And without even realizing that she is developing these maternal instincts, she's always had trouble connecting with kids. And I think it's just because she didn't realize how simple it really was. We're going to talk about the Bone Wars a little bit. Othniel Charles Marsh and Edward Drinker Cope met whenever they were both studying the natural sciences in Germany, and they immediately developed a friendship. So whenever they came back to the United States, Cope wanted to show his friend this fossil quarry that he found because he knew that they both had an interest in it. And so in the interest of friendship, he decided to take Marsh to this fossil quarry and kind of show him what he was finding. And behind Cope's back, Marsh negotiated with the owner of the land that the quarry was on to send any new discoveries directly to Marsh at Yale. Just completely sidestep Cope, even though Cope was the one that found this fossil quarry. This was the start of this intense rivalry between these two men. Over the years, Cope was constantly afraid that Marsh was going to outdo him. Shock, shock, considering what transpired. I mean, I can't blame Cope for having a little bit of anxiety about anything that Marsh could possibly publish. So he committed what historians call taxonomic carpet bombing, which is basically just throwing bookloads of taxonomic discoveries. And taxonomy is the naming of a species. We all know that these are two of the most prolific paleontologists as far as taxonomic discoveries. Whenever we have all of these different discoveries that are being made, each one of these scientists wanted the credit for that discovery. So as Amber says, and Catherine says, a lot of the times they were naming the same dinosaur two different things because they each wanted the credit for naming it. So it took a few centuries for everything to get ironed out and decide who really discovered such and such dinosaur. In the process of needing to make sure that Marsh didn't outdo him, Cope actually purchased the American Naturalist magazine. And this is so it was ensured that all of his discoveries would be widely publicized because everything that he discovered was published in that American Naturalist magazine. He was one of the most prolific geological and paleontological writers in history. He wrote 76 academic papers between 1879 and 1880. In over a two-year period, he wrote 76 academic papers. And over the course of his life, he wrote over 1,400 articles. Like, holy crap, that's a lot of writing. Marsh, on the other hand, was more politically connected than Cope. So he used his influence to be named the chief paleontologist of the U.S. Geological Survey in 1882. And he used his new position to cut Cope off from all government funding. So Lori's sitting here saying, wow, Marsh was kind of a dick. Marsh was a ginormous asshat. So he cut Cope off from all funding, but it's okay because he gets his in the end, sort of. Eventually, he oversteps. He goes so far as to claim that Pope used government funds on his digs to collect fossils. And so he tried to take Cope's fossils from him, like his entire fossil collection. And when it came out that Cope used his own personal fortune to fund these digs he got his fossil collection from, it created such a media firestorm. It lasted 2 weeks of Marsh just getting totally annihilated in the press. This whole shenanigans ended up resulting in Marsh having to surrender his fossil collection to the Smithsonian. And after that happened, he lost his position at USGS. You know, the back and forth was years and years and years. Like, this wasn't one-sided. Cope was constantly retaliating against Marsh, and Marsh was constantly dropping firebombs. And unfortunately, they both died penniless within a couple of years of each other and had completely tarnished reputations from their flair for public scandal, as it was put in the history book. This was an extremely interesting time in history, all for some dinosaur bones. It's just nuts. When we look at how this knowledge impacts our perception of the story and the things that happen to Amber, Leonard Hendricks, the man that pays Amber a visit at the Swiss cottage, is actually working for Dr. Marsh. No surprise there. They believe she's working for Dr. Cope, trying to undermine his discoveries and discredit him. So Marsh has sent these two goons to convince her she needs to cease and desist. Obviously, Amber is not working for Dr. Cope, but Marsh knows that Amber never worked under him, which is the story that she fed the judge when she was standing for her bar examination. So her lies are starting to catch up to her in the most unfortunate way possible. She has this journal that she's done all these sketches of dinosaurs, some of which haven't even been discovered yet. That combined with her information about the brooches and different commentaries that she's had on things that have happened, it's a recipe for disaster, because Hendricks knows the value of what he's holding, and there's nothing that's going to convince him to give it back at that point. He's taking it to Marsh. We all know from what I just said, Marsh is not above taking credit for other people's discoveries. It's frustrating, but when we hear Hendricks is going to Canyon City to take the journal to Mudge, I mean, that's where Olivia and Connor were supposed to be. That's where Daniel was supposed to be. So great, you know, awesome. At least he's going where somebody can knock some sense into him. And they all end up in Pueblo because the trains aren't running to Canyon City. Rick, God bless him, you know, he's like, if I find those sons of bitches, they'll have as much trouble breathing as Amber. And Daniel's right there with him. Like, you know how this story started with Daniel and Rick not getting along and fighting for Amber's attention? Well, she ends up being the thing that brings them together in this. Daniel, he's not working directly with Rick. He's partnering with Connor, but he describes him as Daniel, the looking for a fight Pinkerton. And he's hoping that somebody will tell him the information that he needs in the hopes of just getting him off the streets before he murders somebody. At that point, him and Connor are so tired and pissed off and hungry, and they don't want to be doing what they're doing. But obviously, Amber's journal takes precedence, and Amber takes precedence over their own physiological needs. They're going to keep looking until they find it. Daniel and Connor both end up taking their Pinkerton badges off. That's the signal right there. Like, if they're going to take their Pinkerton badges off because they don't want it to reflect badly on the agency, this next fight, the gloves come off, no holds barred, winner takes all. It is not going to be good when they get their hand on Leonard Hendricks, knowing what he did. And when they lure him from the bar, it's honestly great watching them deal with him. Daniel, for the love of it, pulls him from the saddle, rifles through his bag. It's fantastic. I love seeing Daniel on a mission. Angela says, ain't gonna be pretty. No, it was beautiful to watch in my estimation, because I love seeing our men protect our women in the Brooch series. They are not gonna have mercy. Let's put it that way. Little Noah, we talked about him a little bit when we were talking about Amber, but he deserves his own little slice of the cake. You can just tell by the way he behaves and holds himself. He's talking about, it's okay that my drum's broken, Pa. I'll get by. He doesn't once complain after it kind of soaks in that his drum's gone. That drum had extreme sentimental value. It was sent by his grandfather from Scotland. It was a drum that was used during the Jacobite Rising. He was learning to play it because his mother always wanted him to develop that talent, and he was using learning to play the drum as a way to cope with his mother's loss. That's one big reason that Daniel wants to replace the drum. That way he can preserve Lorna's memory in a way and do something that he knows she would want for their son. On top of all of that, Daniel is quoted as saying, "The lad has never been accused of having idle hands. From the time he wakes up until he falls asleep, he's earning money, keeping up with his studies, or helping our landlady, Mrs. Garland, around the house." So he just can't sit still. But not sitting still is different for Noah than it is for most 10-year-olds. You know, most 10-year-olds are running around like hooligans, playing games, not doing things that are productive. But Noah is. He's being helpful. He's gathering information. He's kind of the town busybody in a lot of ways because he always knows who's coming and who's going. And a lot of adults pay him for information about where the doctor is, where the judge is, where the sheriff is, what's going on. So that's how he makes a lot of his money, is by knowing everybody and everything that's going on in Leadville. I think what's noteworthy about Noah that we haven't already discussed is him as yet another time-traveling child. Kids that are brought forth from different times in the Broach series always adapt extremely well to the 21st century. And Daniel notes, of course, you adapt quickly. That's human nature, because if we didn't live in a civilized society and we didn't adapt quickly, that would not be good for the survival of our species. Time travel is no exception to that. We learn to blend into the environment in which we're placed. And that's exactly what happens to Noah. Whenever he first goes back with Rick, the poor kid, he's just like shaking and trying not to cry. And he's like, "Where are we? I just want to give him a hug." Rick does a good job of like, "I'll explain everything, buddy. I promise. Just hang in there." The only thing he has to compare his experience to is his favorite book, The Adventures of Alice in Wonderland. And he asks, "Did we fall down a rabbit hole?" And I mean, it's not too far from the truth, to be honest. It's funny in a way, but not. He kind of does know what has happened. When they all explain it to him, what has happened, he meets Patrick and Lincoln. In no time flat, he's learned how to text and use a cell phone. He's dressed in 21st century clothing and hanging around with kids his own age. That is part of the reason he does not want to go home. For the first time in his life, he feels like he belongs. He's with boys that are his own age, that match his level of maturity, that are super nice and helpful. And he's already forming relationships with these people, much like he quickly did with Amber. You can't put the genie back in the bottle as easily as you would hope. Not only does Rick realize that, but Daniel quickly realizes it as well when he gets to the 21st century. And his plan is to go visit Amber, make sure he's okay, get Noah, and go back. That was really one of the major reasons that he agreed to go home with Bram and Olivia and Connor and Rick in the first place, was because they assured him that he could come back whenever he wanted to, and it wasn't a permanent decision. That quickly goes out the window when he realizes how happy Noah is in the 21st century. At the end of the day, all Daniel wants is to keep his family happy. So if Amber and Noah are set on doing something, he'll make the sacrifice for their own happiness. I loved Noah's quote, and I think it sums up perfectly what these time travelers experience when they come through the fog. He says, "In the 21st century, folks spend a lot of time making themselves look special, but I've seen their hearts. The McCabes, McBaines, O'Gradys, and Kellys are all good people." So it doesn't really matter, this theme of dishonesty that we have running through it, you know, all the lies and deceptions. They're good people. And when you're able to accept that, as Noah does, because he's an open-minded little kid and he's just got a fantastic laid-back personality in a lot of respects, he trusts people. I love Noah. I'm ready to see him in an adult role, him and Lincoln, because they're two of my favorites. Everybody's my favorite. I know I've said that. As I'm saying that, I realize that. Hands down, JC and Patrick are my favorite second gens. The setting of Leadville, I feel like Catherine always does such a great job with describing setting. You really just feel like you're there, even though it's so far back that it's hard to envision what that looked like, what it smelled like, what it felt like, the people and all of that. She does a really good job of submerging us in this environment and making us feel a tangible connection. Leadville was a boomtown, and we hear that term in history, boomtown. Okay, we know that it's something coming quickly, like being built from the ground up in a very short amount of time, a place that was relatively unheard of, that had a vast influx of people overnight. But what does that look like? What does that sound like? And she does a really good job. She uses simple phrases like substantial but crude, second and third story brick buildings, lining an intersection, and new construction going up everywhere. Day or night, you're hearing the pounding of hammers. It smells like there's fresh hewn timber everywhere. And something interesting, and I'll read you this. So I asked Catherine, what was your inspiration for the Leadville setting with a male main character as a Pinkerton? And she said, I think the idea of Leadville goes back to the Unsinkable Molly Brown movie in 1964. But at the time of the story, Leadville was bigger than Denver. The area had three interests of mine: dinosaurs, railroad wars, and famous gunslingers. It really was a sweet spot for me. A Pinkerton agent was a great job for a former Union officer. There's a lot happening in this area. Obviously, I didn't know much about it, but that blew my mind. At the time, Leadville was bigger than Denver. Now, Leadville's a non-entity and Denver is huge. But at the time, like, how do you convey that? That there's so much being built all the time. So that leads over nicely into the Pinkerton agent topic, which, again, yes, you can say, Chelsea, where have you been? How can you consider yourself somebody that likes history if you've never heard of Pinkerton agents? I had never, before I read this a couple years ago, never heard of a Pinkerton, had no idea what it was, definitely did lots of Googling after I read this book. For those of you, I'm sure you've gathered what it is after reading this book, but it was just an agency started by a man by the last name of Pinkerton. It was sometime in the 19th century. I can't remember if it was before or after the Civil War, but they were basically hired security and they had the ability to make arrests and fulfill warrants in several different states, and they could just come and go as needed. They were basically like Texas Rangers in a way. Like, they had jurisdiction in a lot of different areas, but they were a privately owned entity. They weren't government employees in the way that we think of like the FBI being now. But they were kind of like the beginnings of the FBI in the United States before the FBI was a thing. Daniel is the 19th century equivalent of an FBI agent, if you want to look at it that way. She's right in thinking that like a Pinkerton is a perfect job for someone that was a Union officer. And then you come out of the war and you're like, okay, well, what do I do with my life now? Go into law enforcement. That's something that is translatable from the skills that you acquired during the war. We see Daniel's life experience come through and how he holds himself. Amber describes it as every man he passed either tipped his hat in recognition or stepped aside to allow Daniel the right of way. He didn't move for anyone. And it wasn't just his height, it was the way he carried himself with military precision. Even before she knows who he is or what he does, she can tell just by the way other people are around him that he is likely some sort of law enforcement, was definitely in the war. And whenever she learns that he works for the Rio Grande, comes to a reasonable conclusion that he knew General Palmer during the war, and that's how he got his connection with Rio Grande. She doesn't know he's a Pinkerton at the time, but I think that that's a logical leap to make. He has a lot of skills that are very translatable to being a Pinkerton. Whenever we look at what he did during the war, he was on Lincoln's Secret Service. Like, he was protecting the president. That was his job during the war. Naturally, someone in that position would have observation skills. They would constantly be scanning the room, scanning a crowd, making sure that no one had ill intentions, that they were always taking the temperature of people around them. And that translates really well into his job. Because as a Pinkerton, you're just looking for things that are out of the ordinary. You are constantly keeping the pulse of any wanted posters that are out there, reporting suspicious activity. He does that a lot. He reports back to the office in Chicago, asking if any of the McClintock clan that he's encountering have warrants out for their arrest just because they are really suspicious and that's his job. You know, I asked Catherine, is Daniel's hellbent inquisition more of a perceived threat or an actual problem? She said that it was a perceived threat for sure. We're seeing him through the eyes of Amber a lot of the time. He dots his I's and crosses his T's. He wants to make sure he's not letting anything fall through the cracks. But I think he's actually far more curious about her than he is wanting to pin something on her. It's not necessarily that he thinks she's got ill intentions or that she's running from the law. Amber points out a couple of different times how he is observant in different ways. One of my favorite scenes is right after her performance at the opera house. They're in the back dressing room together. Amber is annoyed with him. She's wondering where her guitar is, and he says, "The stagehand returned the instrument to its case and left it next to the chair you were using on the stage. He also left this, money from your fans." And she says, "How did you know that? About my guitar, I mean." He says, "I'm paid to notice, Miss Kelly, and you left your reticule on the table there." He picks up little details. He retains those details, and we see that over and over again throughout his time with the McClintock clan and throughout the story. He's very similar to David in that way, like noticing the little things. I think Rick is like that too. That's their military training. That's just the way they are. Amber notes, at first she thought that he was a man of few words, but as she gets to know him, she's realizing that it's not that he's a man of few words. He's actually a really great conversationalist. It's just that he prefers to kind of stand in the background and watch people. She notes that she feels like a firefly in a jar under his gaze because he's just trying to figure her out. He's a problem solver and he loves puzzles, much like a lot of our characters in the Broach series. A lot of times that curiosity just comes across as nefarious for Amber. I think as suspicious as we claim Daniel is, she's just as suspicious. Like she just doesn't trust that he's got good intentions. I don't know. Maybe that's her own dishonesty and her guilt over that bleeding over into her perception of other people's behavior. When I was reading this, I had a thought because Daniel was giving me vibes and I was trying to figure out what the vibe was. And then it clicked. He really reminds me of Cullen in the Ruby Broach. He's got this stubborn streak, but he's also super curious and intelligent. That's the way that Cullen was with Kit. Like he knew that she was different, but logic told him that the truth couldn't really be the truth. There had to be another explanation for it. He's also so mercurial in a way. Like he'll get so pissed off because he knows she's lying, but then he'll turn around and say something like, "You've been kind. I've been rude." And then he says, "I know you're hiding something and I won't quit looking until I discover what it is." He respects what she did in saving Noah, just like Kit saved that little boy in the Kansas River. So there's actually a lot of parallels between the Ruby Broach and the Amber Broach when you look at it that way. At a certain point, he realizes what Amber's lying about might not actually be what he thinks it is. Because I think his initial impression or suspicion is that she's running from the law in some capacity. And I think as he gets to know her and talk to her and everything, he realizes that just because she's keeping secrets, it doesn't necessarily mean that she's lying to him because he's a Pinkerton agent. It might be because she's running from something else in her life, like an abusive husband. There are so many reasons besides illegal activity to hide your identity or want to start over. There's this one quote, and I love this line, so I wanted to make sure to mention it. It says, "The lamplight chased the shadows away, revealing a look of concern etched into his face. And for a moment, he looked more like a dad than a Pinkerton." Underneath that hard exterior, he's got a soft, mushy heart like most of our McClintock men. And I think as it dawns on him that this situation might not call for the tough guy act, it might call for a little tender love and care. It just makes you realize that hard exterior, that Pinkerton serious face, is really probably just an act in a lot of respects. this story actually creates quite a beautiful arc for Daniel as a main character. When we first meet him, he's very comfortable in his role. He's got life figured out. Mrs. Garland is helping him take care of Noah. They're kind of in a rhythm, right? At this point, he's been a widower for 5 years. They've got things down as far as how they live life. But over the course of meeting Amber and all the things that he deals with the railroad and being blamed for the shit show at Pueblo, he's realizing that he's ready to leave the Pinkertons behind. That goes hand in hand with his desire to love again. He's really ready to turn the page and start a new chapter in his life. It made it a very easy decision for him because when he's almost shot in Pueblo, he realizes his job could have very easily made his son an orphan. He loves Noah more than life itself. And the thought of leaving his son alone scares him more than his own death, is what he says. Like I said, it made it very cut and dry on, okay, I can't do this anymore because my son needs me. And if I'm dead, nobody in this world is here to protect him. I'm his only family. Because he knows Alec is not going to do that. Yes, Alec is his family. And he cares what happens to Noah on a technical level because Noah is his only heir to his fortune. But as we learn throughout the story, Alec cares about like where the kid goes to school and what clothes he wears and things like that, the superficial things. But he'll also pick up at the drop of a hat and go to San Francisco and leave Noah with the nursemaid. That's not the life that Daniel wants for him. And that's why he didn't want to leave Noah with Alec in the first place. I mean, I don't think Daniel has a problem with Alec. They get along okay. He just expects more of a person that's going to care for his son. He would never willingly put Noah in that situation. So if there's something he can do on his end to avoid that, then by all means, that's what he's going to do. Daniel being prepared to leave the Pinkertons goes hand in hand with him being ready to open his heart again. I love that arc for him. Obviously, the story is taking place at an opportune point in his life. That's how the brooches work. You don't meet anybody before you're intended to meet them. He definitely feels an attraction to Amber from the get-go, but I think part of him is struggling with how to be attracted to Amber, but also mourn the loss of his wife as well. That's a very real thing to feel and struggle with as a widower. He's almost embarrassed to admit that he's attracted to her. I love that scene where he sees the dress that she's going to wear. And he was like, is that the dress for your performance tonight? And she said, yeah, Mrs. Garland's insisting I wear it. And he said, you should, you'll look Bonnie in it. And then he's almost like, oh my God, I can't believe I just said that. He's so cute in how he approaches things. And I love how he's being very delicate and cautious and asking Amber to dinner after the performance. And Noah is just like, oh my God, get on with it. This little 10-year-old boy. And he's just like, we're going to dinner and he made reservations. Do you want to go with us? She's funny. She makes a comment and says, I'd be happy to be his rebound, but he needed to leave his Pinkerton badge at home, which I can't blame her. She's just tired of being asked questions. The further they get in their relationship, the more and more his jealousy starts to show, which I think is where we see him connecting to David a little bit, because that's exactly how David was in his jealousy to Cav in the Emerald Brooch. I love the way that he describes it. He says, the ache in his gut was like the ache that had batted him about while he sat in the proscenium box at the Tabor Opera House. But it hadn't been a wrenching ache then. What was the difference? It wasn't one thing. It was him. He was different. In Leadville, he had yet to kiss her or hold her in his arms or fall in love. Now that he's got this attachment to her on this visceral level, he almost can't think about anything else. But he really struggles with her need to keep secrets from him. And that is the biggest hurdle in their relationship, is getting past the fact that she's not being completely honest with him, because it has to be a conscious decision. He has to decide that it's not worth getting in the way of their relationship, this need that he has to know everything. And once he makes that decision, it's very easy for him to fall the rest of the way. They have this fantastic moment, their last night together before all the time travel happens, where he just lays with her in bed. No sex or anything. That to me almost seems more tender than any love scene could be. You know that they have to love each other to just lay in bed together. And he's so happy. I love how Olivia was like, and I swear to God, Amber, he whistled. Like, that man is in love. It's a really great moment to see him admit how much he needs her, how much he wants her in his life. Noah, finally, when they reunite in the 21st century, gets up the nerve to ask his dad, like, look, I love Amber and I want her to be my mom. Do you love her enough to marry her? Daniel admits that he does, but again, they have to get her well again, and that's the priority. But it's just that journey that he went on emotionally to not only be willing to love someone again, like open his heart to getting hurt, but going through that complete arc of realizing that he really does care for Amber in that way. And I think we see that play out in how concerned he is over her health. He's constantly urging her to go to the doctor. And really that urgency, I mean, other than being a sane person, can really be interpreted to the fact that he already lost his wife due to some medical emergency. And the last thing he wants is to have finally opened up to love again and lose the second love of his life to a medical emergency simply because she didn't want to go to the doctor. It really flows nicely into the whole idea of Amber and Daniel's relationship. As with every broach couple, there are certain types of writing techniques and one-line mentions and things like that that draw these subtle connections between characters. One thing that is mentioned is their love of nature. And it's so far apart that unless you're really looking, it's hard to notice. But literally in the first chapter, we see the line of Amber. It's in her POV. It says, after a quick stomp up the plank steps to shake off the remaining mud, she did what she always did, stopped to take in the view. She loves being out in nature. We see that contrasted very starkly with Olivia's need for her creature comforts. But Amber just likes to be there. She's such a free spirit compared to all the other members of the clan, I feel like. We see that tied in with when they're in the carriage and everybody's asleep except for Daniel. And in his POV, it says, the ageless sound of raging water, cold and swirling as it tumbled over rocks and tangled debris, moved Daniel to a rare state of peace. So they both find such comfort in the Colorado area and like just nature in general that it honestly really surprises me that they didn't end up back in Colorado. I know that they settled at Mallory Plantation because Daniel had a relationship with Bram and that really gives him some peace of mind. Also, as soon as Daniel goes through the fog and arrives at Mallory Plantation, he feels this overwhelming sense of peace, a little slice of heaven on the James River. That all combined with the fact that Noah has such a great relationship with Patrick and Lincoln, who also live there, it seemed like a natural next step for them to stay there. Charlotte and Bram were going to give them a piece of land for them to build a house and for Amber to have Amber's kitchen. And they were going to create this partnership with Bram to sell his boutique wines. It all worked out very flawlessly, but I'm honestly so surprised that they did not go back to Colorado to be with Olivia and Connor. So Amber and Daniel, being soulmates, have this connection almost on a molecular level. It goes beyond an emotional connection. It's like a physical connection. And every couple in the Broach series has that on some level. But we see it mentioned in two different ways. They each at some point say it in their own way. Daniel, he says, no amount of deliberating could erase what had become an illogical passion. So against all odds, against whatever logic says about how he should feel, he has formed this attachment to Amber. Amber says it as she grew more and more in love with him each moment they spent together. He seduced her with his compassion and thoughtfulness. Whenever he touched her, he did so with gentleness and strength, charm and steely patience, and she marveled at how powerfully she was drawn to him. It's just those personal characteristics that all swirl together into this, not necessarily fatal attraction, but it's just irrevocably changes whoever it touches. Sexual relationship or lack thereof in this book, I think, is one of the things that really stands out to me personally and marks their relationship as different because they're patient with each other in that way. It's not that that desire isn't there, but it's the ability to wait until it's the right time that's so different from other books. I feel like, especially when we look at books with Kevin and JL and David and Kenzie, there was such this carnal need to be naked with each other at that exact moment. There was very little patience involved. Not to say that they don't feel this charge in the air around each other. Amber, she has this steamy dream. And when she wakes up from it, she just knows. She wants to know Daniel on every level. And she says she had to know if he was it, the missing link in her life, the completeness she'd never found in random hookups or long-term lovers. Not that she had broad experience, but she wasn't a virgin either. But if he was the one, how could she leave him? This is where this question of how could she leave really starts to filter into the subconscious awareness of the story, so to speak. I felt like there were so many little clues to this predicament peppered into the story. But she talks about this need to be near him, and it really filters in to Daniel and his POV. And a few chapters later, he's talking about this exact same need. It's almost like they're literally on the same wavelength. And his point of view says he was kind of the same mind about it, that they could sleep together and it would probably be fantastic, but he knew that one time would not be enough. This literally reads into her quote, and it says, although she wanted him to be thinking of her, she didn't want him distracted from the work he was sent to do in Canyon City. Instead of thinking of her, she'd settle for being remembered in an erotic way when he fell asleep at night. She's dreaming of him and she wants him to be dreaming of her. And oh God, does he dream of her? One thing that I have really noticed, much like the Cullen Daniel parallel that I drew earlier, I've noticed that whenever we get 19th and 20th century men that come forward into the future, so I'm talking Cullen, Bram, Daniel, those are the characters that have such a old-timey romantic quality to their courtship. We're talking love letters and this romanticized language, and just their idea of romance is completely different. Not to say that our clan men are not uber romantic, because they definitely are and obviously are fantastic lovers. But there's such a difference with the men that move forward in time to join the clan. And we see that in Daniel's love note that he writes her. He says, I woke with the taste of you on my lips. What I feel for you has taken thorough possession of my wits and makes me almost unfit for anything else. Until we meet again, your devoted servant, Daniel. I'm like, come on. I love the conversation between Olivia and Amber whenever Olivia's reading that note. And she's like, Christ, Amber, this guy can write Hallmark cards. Well, Olivia notes that she wouldn't mind having a letter like that, but also she understands Connor has his own love language that is very specific to him and makes sense for his personality and his upbringing. There's this distinct question that I always had in the back of my mind as I read this story. It's, will she stay or will he go? It was obviously very clear that they were soulmates and they were going to end up together somehow, some way. But what was the way? Because at this point in the series, we'd had Kit stay and we've had Bram go. Then we've also had completely modern 21st century individuals that have ended up together. So it was really a wild card on what was going to happen. We saw lots of different clues all throughout that kind of hinted at the fact that Amber might in fact stay. So I asked Catherine, I said, in your opinion, would Amber have stayed in 1878 if she hadn't got sick? And she said she might have. I could see her living there, marrying Daniel and having children. I'm glad I'm not the only one that sees this, but there were several little clues that were dropped in. There was this one quote that really got me thinking about it. So it's Amber saying, he was a man who made decisions and stuck by them, a man who defended those he loved, a man who fought for values and beliefs, a man with intellectual curiosity. A shock of recognition blew through her. Those were the must-have boyfriend traits she had listed in her first lock and key diary long ago. In that moment, uneasy possibility stole past her recognition and encamped in her mind, a possibility she couldn't dislodge, could she stay in the past to be with him? So it's even crossed her mind. She's like, is this something that I potentially want to pursue? I don't know. That's a huge decision to make. But it's not just that. It's not just the black and white neon flashing sign that says, hey, this is something she's thinking about. We also have the little things, like how much she likes the way that she looks in 1878 clothing, how happy she is there planning shopping trips and going to afternoon tea with Mrs. Garland and Mrs. Hughes, performing at the Tabor Opera House. She realizes it's him that makes her happy and it's him that she wants to be with. It's just she has to make that decision. She says she finally understood that knowing him, loving him, would leave her forever torn between the centuries. She's a modern 21st century woman. Is love enough for her to give up her creature comforts and live in the 19th century? And eventually we get to a place where Amber realizes that she does want to go home. But at that point, she's so emotionally invested in Daniel and Noah, she wants to ask Daniel to come home with her. But she doesn't know if he's going to say yes. I asked Catherine, if Noah hadn't been already in the 21st century, do you think that Daniel would have thought that it was plausible for them to go forward? Like, would he have thought that was too much of a risk to take Noah and go? And she said that yes, like if Noah had been in the 19th century when that decision had to be made, he probably would have erred on the side of caution and thought it was better for his son and him to stay. The impetus for him going is because everything that he cared about was already there and he felt like he needed to be there to protect his son. So likely if Amber had not gotten sick, it would have been a Bram Charlotte situation for a long time of them being separated for years because Daniel didn't want to go and Amber didn't want to stay. That's why the illness was such a major playing card in this story. So we're going to talk about the Pueblo shootout and how that all unfolded. Amber and Olivia were aware that the shootout at the Pueblo Roundhouse happened, but they never really thought that it was that big of a deal. They didn't think that it was something they were going to have to contemplate because they were only supposed to go to Canyon City and then they were supposed to go home. They were never supposed to get involved in Pueblo. Then plans changed at the last minute and Olivia and Connor ended up having to go to Pueblo. That's where Daniel was and that's where all the action was happening and the trains were down to certain places. The Pueblo Roundhouse was a complex that was literally a round building that was built to reposition trains on the tracks because back in that time, it was before trains could go forward and backwards. So they literally had to turn trains around to go back the way they came. And that's what this roundhouse's function was. And that's also why it was such a strategic position in the war between Santa Fe and Rio Grande. If there wasn't that switch there, then it made it much more difficult for certain people's trains to go in and out of Leadville and the surrounding cities. Santa Fe had Ben Thompson and 40 of his men there at the roundhouse. But whenever Connor and Olivia arrived, there were just men armed to the teeth everywhere, ready to shoot people. It was just a very dangerous situation. And so obviously Connor was extra cautious in keeping his eye on everybody because he knew tensions were high and very trigger happy. It was messy from the get-go. I liked how this setting provided some interesting commentary on history. One of the major themes for this part of the book was commentary on the accuracy of history. And this goes hand in hand with the theme of dishonesty that we talked about last week. But I think that it's a bit of a different flavor. History records one thing, but it's not usually exactly like it happened. There is a tendency towards tall tales and also inaccuracy. The winners tell the story. So naturally, they're going to blow certain things out of proportion and then shove other things under the rug. For this particular situation, Olivia had the idea of history and the fact that there was a mountain howitzer, there were 60 men, and that Bat Masterson and Doc Holliday were there. And all of this was going to go down. And she felt very confident in that because she had this historical knowledge. But when we look at the full story and the scouting report that Daniel had, his scouts had just gotten back. There was no cannon or anything like that at the state arsenal. Bat Masterson and Doc Holliday were in Canyon City, nowhere near Pueblo, and that Ben Thompson was actually in the roundhouse, and he had 40 men with him, not 60 men. So there were a lot of inaccuracies, like certain things they got right, but also certain things were false. And this confusion went hand in hand with Daniel's suspicion of these people, because how do they have this information and what is the goal of them telling me X, Y, Z? At the end of the day, he has to trust his intelligence given to him by his scouts and their scouting reports. But he also has to answer to Whitebreck and other members of the Rio Grande board. So he needs to make sure he has all his ducks in a row, and Olivia is not making him look very good. Connor makes the comment, funny thing about history, once it's written, it's hard to correct the record. And if this goes down the way I think it will, with forcible removal, false imprisonments, and bribery, no one will ever want the record to reflect what actually happened. And it's true. If there's things being done under the table and inappropriately, nobody is going to want that to be written in history books. Look at how Whitebreck and the sheriff wanted things to happen. The Supreme Court ruling came down. The sheriff and his deputy had to go to Santa Fe and deliver the writ saying, you need to vacate. This is now Rio Grande property per the decree of the Supreme Court. The sheriff doesn't want any trouble. He would be happy as a clam if both railroads just packed up and left. I mean, he doesn't want anybody to get killed. He doesn't want shots to have to be fired. But Whitebreck wants his property back, and he doesn't care what has to happen for that to get done. That makes him extremely dangerous. That's what's going to lead to a bunch of drunks with guns shooting at people, because they're going to deputize all these people that have been drinking at the bar all day. He makes it perfectly clear to the sheriff that shots may be necessary to get Santa Fe to vacate. And if he's not willing to do what needs done, Rio Grande will be pulling their support from him come election time. There's lots of shady shit going on with this. I think it is very noteworthy that Connor makes sure to tell Daniel, this isn't what's going to go down in history. History is looking at things with rose-colored glasses. Obviously, the people recording it are going to tell it in the shiniest and polished way versus the gritty details about how people were basically bribed to vacate, which is what happened in the story. They gave Ben Thompson and his men $10,000 to get the hell out of Dodge. Side note on this, literally these stories, despite all the conversations with experienced travelers talking to inexperienced travelers about keep your nose out of it, don't do anything to try to change history, da 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 da. Of course, Connor goes and sticks his nose in it. I mean, as if Olivia and Amber's interference wasn't enough, and then Connor hires this newspaper guy to be like, yeah, you tell the real story and follow these people around and da 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 da. I get what he's trying to do. He wants the record to reflect what actually happened. But at the same time, I'm like, bro, why can't you just let it be? We're going to wrap up with talking about some of the clan dynamics for this story. I always love analyzing how new characters come into the clan and impact the existing relationships and interact with characters that we've met previously. But I also enjoy watching the growth of characters that are existing within the clan and how their relationships build over the course of the series. One particular relationship that I adore to the moon and back, as Olivia would say, is David and JL. I know that a lot of people don't like JL, but honestly, I kind of like her. She's a tough girl, but she has a good heart. She has a lot of brothers and she has a son, so she's used to not taking shit from anybody and also busting balls at the same time. And I think that's great for her relationship with David. They have a very brother-sister relationship, which I think for women that have brothers, it's really easy to form that bond with other men that remind them of their brothers, if that makes sense. And I think that's the way David is. David is that warrior protector mentality, and it reminds her of Connor and Rick and Shane and Jeff. they have such a fun rapport. There's always this tinge of care and concern around them. We see it from the very beginning when David's like, Christ, you can't carry that. It's as big as you are, when she's going to get her plant from her office. David is the one that thought of her new position at Mac Corp. We see it in the little things too, like JL's keeping an eye on David because he's been acting grumpy and avoiding spicy foods. So she knows that his ulcer is acting up, and she's the one that points it out with Kinsey in the room, by the way, and says, your brawn will never cure the painful sores in your stomach lining, but medication will. And Olivia notes, she's like, you two aren't brother and sister, but you act like it. JL is naturally like a mother figure, and she wants to protect those around her. Her brothers are no exception, even though they're older than her. So JL is naturally really pissed at David when he comes home without Rick. After everything that has just gone down with Rick in Afghanistan, she doesn't think that he's at the right place emotionally and mentally to be able to handle being left in the 19th century. And she even tells David, she says, I've never questioned your judgment, but you left them behind. You shouldn't have done that. If anything happens to my brother, I'll never forgive you. David expected her to be angry. Who wouldn't be? And he's already dealt with Connor's anger. So he would expect JL to react no less than that. But he also has to find a way to walk the fine line of telling her that he's a grown man, he can make his own decisions, and you're not his mother. There's really no way to delicately deliver that, I guess. It's just fun to watch how they interact with each other. David and Daniel is a new dynamic that I love. And as much as I was surprised that we didn't see the Rick and Amber relationship drift over into other books, the David and Daniel one really surprised me, because David describes his relationship with Daniel. He says the friendship they had developed could, aside from Kinsey, be David's longest lasting affair. So he has this instantaneous connection with Daniel. I'm really curious what that looks like on the day to day. I mean, if Daniel stays at Mallory Plantation, I know him and David aren't in close proximity to each other 100% of the time, but I'm really curious to see, did they become really good friends? Do they bounce things off of each other? Like, they really seem to have that connective relationship. They appear like brothers, and I forget who compares it, but they say that it's almost like Bram and Cullen in that way. Like, they're bookends. They're the same height, weight, bone structure, similar voices, raw magnetism, but David is dark and Daniel is fair. That's kind of how I envision that, is like a Bram-Cullen relationship. And since Daniel reminds me so much of Cullen, like, I could totally see that being a thing. In the infancy of their relationship, David has some insecurity about Daniel, because not only is Daniel a Fraser, or related to a Fraser by marriage, he doesn't want Daniel to see David performing on stage at the Tabor Opera House and perceive David as some frivolous performer. David doesn't mind performing for friends and family, because back in the 21st century, everyone knows that he's a military man. He protects the clan. He's the president of Mac Corp, and it's his job to see to the safety and security of everyone. And they all respect him for that. But Daniel doesn't know that about David. He wants Daniel to respect him as a man, and he doesn't feel like he can be honest with Daniel about who he is and what he does. And so he's afraid that if Daniel does come forward in time, he'll have that initial impression of David versus what David actually wants him to know and how David wants him to feel. And then there's also that innate worry that Elliot is going to show some sort of preferential treatment to Daniel. And of course, Kinsey shuts that down, and she's like, you're being unreasonable. You'll always be Elliot's firstborn, okay? He has a relationship with you that he's never going to have with anyone else. And that doesn't mean that he's not going to welcome Daniel with open arms, but you're being ridiculous. David, when he comes back to 1878 in round two, he offers Daniel a job. And because Daniel is already kind of fed up with being a Pinkerton agent, being gone so long, and not being able to offer Amber a stable lifestyle, he's already contemplating leaving the agency anyway. And then when David offers him a job, he's very much on board with it before he even considers much of the details or has anything to go off of. He doesn't really know what he's getting into, but he's like, yes, he wants to accept it on the spot. But David's like, maybe you should just think about it for a minute. So yeah, I think that there's a level of trust between them. They're very much on the same wavelength about a lot of things. And it's good to watch them. I like their relationship. The last thing that we're going to chat about today is Bram and Daniel and their relationship. And I know that a lot of people really like this dynamic. I don't have a ton to talk about on it, but I just find it so interesting that Bram and Daniel knew each other when Bram lived back in the 19th century before he went to Charlotte after the war. It's really cool to kind of see that dynamic because Bram is a face that Daniel trusts. After Charlotte left, before Bram went back to California, he actually spent some time looking for the Confederate gold with a group of Union soldiers. And Daniel was one of those men, was looking for the Confederate gold. They knew each other very well. And obviously, Daniel was on Lincoln's security detail. So Bram knew him from working side by side with President Lincoln. When Daniel learns that Bram knew Lincoln was going to be assassinated and didn't stop it, I think that for like a short period of time diminishes a little bit of Daniel's respect for Bram. They both have a lot of regrets about that night and what happened. Daniel can't fathom the fact that Bram knew that was going to happen to someone that they both admired and loved. There was nothing that he could do to stop it. It lessens the blow a little bit when he learns that Bram was actually caught up in the assassination attempt on Secretary Seward and actually had several battle wounds from that experience. But Daniel doesn't understand how Bram couldn't tell anybody what was going to happen. And I think that Bram makes a valid argument. You know, it's so many years on from what happened. And he says, I could have said something, but he was a huge target for several assassination attempts. Lincoln knew somebody was going to try something at some point. And if he had thwarted Booth's attempt and the conspirators' attempt to assassinate Lincoln that night, they just would have recalibrated their plans and come back at it from a different angle. The hope for Bram was that he could go to the theater with the Lincolns and prevent it from happening. Obviously, that couldn't happen because of an assignment that Lincoln gave him to go to Secretary Seward's house. That night was so devastating for so many people, especially Daniel, who was literally right there. It made it beyond comprehension to find out that someone knew about it and could have potentially stopped it. Once Daniel has time to reflect on it and learn about the ins and outs of time travel and what people can and can't do as far as changing history, when they tell him, like, look, we've been able to change little things, but never big things. Like, we've never been able to prevent things like that. That makes him feel a little bit better and makes it a little bit more palatable. It still stings 100% because he feels like he failed to protect his president. I can imagine him wanting to try to place blame and eliminate some of his guilt. Because there's so much trust between Bram and Daniel, Bram believes that he is probably the best person to be able to break the news to Daniel that Noah and Amber are in the 21st century. He's had that revelation dumped on him before. He has a broad scope idea of how to handle those kinds of situations. He also knows Daniel. He knows his personality and that he probably needs to digest the whole time travel thing in pieces. But the more he thinks about it, he handles it very much like he handles revealing something to Cullen. The way he handles telling Daniel reminded me a lot of Bram meeting Cullen at the train station in The Three Brooches. He pushes all of Cullen's buttons until Cullen explodes because he knows if he can force his friend into being angry, then he can just get it off his chest and they can move on. So that's kind of what he does with Daniel. He pushes his buttons and pushes his buttons. Do you want a cigar? Do you want a drink? Like, oh, we'll talk about it here in a second. Saying all the things that are just going to make steam come out of his ears until he finally explodes. And he says, I don't want a damn cigar. I don't want whiskey. You're stalling. And that makes me madder than hell. If my hands are shaking, it's because they want to wrap around your neck and squeeze the truth from you. Spill it. My hands aren't going to listen to me much longer. I love their bond. Like I said, I completely understand that that bond is of comfort to Daniel, and that probably has a lot to do with why he and Amber and Noah decided to stay in Virginia versus going to Colorado. Here's hoping that we get to see these characters a little bit more as the series continues. He's such a great character. Amber, too. I'm not necessarily upset about not seeing Olivia because she's not my flavor or my speed. But yeah, I do miss Amber and Noah and Daniel. Well, that's all I have for today. In the next couple of weeks, I will be putting together my deleted, extended, and additional scenes for season 4. That'll be my next podcast. And then I'm going to LandCon in Paris. I'm planning to do a LandCon podcast when I get back with all the deets. But I'll also probably do a live or two here in this group while I'm in Paris. Alrighty, guys. Have a great one, and I will chat at you later. Bye.